Thank you. That's Horace Silver and his quintet with Pretty Eyes. Horace, of course, on piano, Woody Shaw on trumpet, Joe Henderson on tenor sax, J.J. Johnson on trombone, Bob Cranshaw on bass, and Roger Humphreys on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrecht Lead. It's Thursday, November the 8th. And a wonderful, wonderful reunion, thanks to Hurricane Sandy and also to the philanthropic spirit of Gary Mell, who made the studios available to WBAI that suffered a loss of its airtime. And so I think he accommodated the station. And we had a little separation. So now the separation anxiety is over, and we're back with each other again. Yeah, well, it's Thursday, as I said, and President Barack Obama's re-election remains a puzzlement, a stunning puzzlement, especially to the experts. But, of course, not knowing what they're talking about, in many cases, has never, ever prevented the experts from talking. So today I thought we would revisit this event and really understand the enormity of it. And to understand the enormity of it, you almost have to go behind it. There's so much going on behind it. When I talk about listening to a speech, I make it very clear that the task is to listen for what is not said. When you watch something, you watch television, you look for what is not shown, blatantly shown. You pick up your clues and you begin to stitch these pieces together, the pieces that are not so blatantly obvious, and you come up with a very interesting picture when all is said and done. Of course, experts, especially analysts of this political season, as they're calling it, tend to be quite literal about things. And there's a reason. Because, again, this goes back to a race-based theory. Anything involving people of color is usually not that deep. It's fairly easy to understand. It's quite literal. I'll give you an example. Years and years ago, I was in the Village in New York City and just hanging around, and I bump into a friend of mine on West 4th Street. And there's a white guy, photographer, and we started talking. And along comes a friend of mine, another friend of mine, and we started talking right on the corner. I introduced these two friends who had not known each other. We started talking. And the conversation got to be really, really good. And I said, well, you know, we're right across from a jazz club, and Roy Haynes, the legendary drummer, was doing a set that was to start fairly soon. So why don't we go over there and spend a little bit of time with Roy Haynes? And they said, that's great. So we go over there, and Roy Haynes just explodes. I mean, just the most explosive performance on the drums I have ever seen. It was like he had 20 arms or something. But he just goes nuts. It was so wonderful. And my black friend says, oh, man. That was bad. My white friend says, looks at him in horror, looks at me with horror, and says, how could you say something like that? That he was pretty good. know, it was a joke. We started laughing. And then we had to explain why we were laughing. Because the word bad was not to be taken literally as being not good. It in fact meant real good. But my white friend didn't know that. So we had to have a conversation about meaning. It's the same thing. And I'm going to get into this because we have to start talking about these things. When we are hearing analysis of Barack Obama, we always get a one-dimensional, we get a one-note kind of thing. It's just straightforward, straight up. There's no depth there. There's no dimension to him. He's a flat surface. He's one-dimensional. End of story. It is what it is. But we know it ain't what it is. It's much more. So there's where I'm going today. Barack Obama began to mystify America, all of America, quite a while ago. And clearly it was because he had an ambition, he had a political ambition, and made it real. He ran for the state house in Chicago. And by the time he decided to run for the U.S. Senate, a couple of things had happened. One, he became involved in organizing efforts in the city of Chicago, so he was an organizer. And two, he was adopted by political tutors in the African-American community who took him under their wings, taught him pretty much what they knew, not all that he knew, of course, but taught him the essentials of politics and baptized him, if you will, in the way politics is done in the city of Chicago. And in receiving him that way, made him, created for him what he did not have on his own, which is an organic link to a community. His organizing efforts, of course, were part of that as well. But he had the beginnings of a voting bloc. He had the beginnings of an organized effort that would buoy his political ambitions. And he had the benefit of people who were very, very encouraging because they spotted something special in him. And they gave of themselves the knowledge, the skills, they shared all of that with him, which you can't pay for. And they gave him something else that he did not have, which was territory, turf, fertile soil in which to grow. And he did grow because he had political ambitions, and nothing is wrong with that. But in a way, Obama is like the Oprah Winfrey of politics. And oddly enough, she too comes out of Chicago. And why is he like the Oprah Winfrey? Because Oprah Winfrey, there was nothing happening at the time that Oprah Winfrey came along as a communicator that would have suggested that she was destined for success. Certainly not the magnitude of success that she now enjoys. So somebody, and you know, we've never heard from him again. They found this guy a place in the coldest spot of Siberia someplace who opened up that little sluice and let her in. And once her foot was in the door, she just mashed everything up. She set standards they'd never seen. She went success after success after success. She did not look like what they required on-air people to look like. She had kinky hair. She had a broad nose and full lips. And most of all, she had melanin. My God, how are you going to have a person with melanin? A lot of melanin. At the time, the media was the most racist it has been. It has not changed, I want you to know. It is still a racist institution, as you well could see. And the gamble was, we give her a little break. We get to boast about our liberal credentials. We get to fulfill our EEO requirements with Oprah Winfrey. They got a twofer. They got a black and they got a woman. So nobody in Chicago could say they were racist. But they had no idea that this woman, once she got through the gate, would just fling everything right open and just create all kinds of crazy havoc. Crazy havoc that I mean is to go where nobody expected, not just her to go. I want to make this clear. Not just her, but to go where she, in the end, took the entire industry. She was a game changer for the entire industry and still is. Now, that's what I mean, the comparison. So in both cases, these people threw all of the rules, they made them redundant. Their standards and their level of performance was so high, they could not possibly even understand what it is they were looking at. All they knew was, this is different from everything we know. And therefore, resistance to it was natural. Now, I had talked on this program before about Barack Obama's greatest instruction since running for Senate, U.S. Senate, is that without it being said, it was clear that he recognized early in the game he could not achieve anything within the confines of the Democratic Party as it was organized then and as it is organized now. The Democratic Party was a racist party. The Democratic Party was the party of the separatists and the Dixiecrats. The Democratic Party had to be shamed by Fannie Lou Hamer and our guest we had recently, Lawrence Guyot of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, had to be shamed into just opening up the gates a little bit and letting black folks and Latinos and women in a meaningful way. However, it was not lost on Barack Obama that he had to construct not a parallel institution, but an alternative institution that he controlled, that he designed. And right now, we are at that point where his approach to politics and organizing created a division so decisive in the world of politics as to be just like the division of time between BC and AD. That's how revolutionary, that's how extraordinary this is. The experts are telling us pretty much that people liked him because he's a young guy. He has nice teeth. He dresses well. Went to Harvard. You know the silly simpleton stuff that we get. They're not discussing the genius of constructing a top-to-bottom juggernaut. They've never seen anything like this before. They probably won't see anything like it again. And that is where I'm going today. Now, as you know, I am critical of Barack Obama for a number of reasons, but that's for another day. Today, I'm talking about what he has done in the world of politics and what's behind it all. So, Barack Obama distinguished himself from another Chicagoan who ran for office, and that's the Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson, who was brought in. It was a case of the tail wagging the dog, really. He wanted to run for president, but the people organized themselves. The coalition that came to be known as the Rainbow Coalition organized themselves behind Jesse Jackson. And they delivered convincingly a message to all parties concerned that the power was there to harness and to bring together for a broader constituency in which we had a number of component parts that historically never dealt with each other as coalitions. Somehow, with Jesse Jackson, they managed to overcome all those hurdles and brought themselves into a coalition. But make no mistake, they did the work. They did the work. But Jackson, who ran as a true insurgent in 1984, became a willing hostage of the Democratic Party in 1988. It took him only 4 years to sell out completely. And in fact, to this day, I blame the Rainbow Coalition for this. They have yet to publicly cancel his contract because he acts like he has one. In fact, he heads up an entity called Rainbow Coalition / Push. He usurped it. He took it as a personal possession. And nobody in the Rainbow Coalition has said, hey, you are not going to run around as ambassador without portfolio here. You have Push, great. You did not create the Rainbow Coalition. The Rainbow Coalition created you. So that's a distinct difference in approach that Obama had, in which his organizing efforts were truly that. Organizing, not just mobilizing, but organizing. And I've said to you, there's a great difference. Organizing is not mobilizing. Mobilizing is not organizing, but the two are related. You can mobilize 2 million West Indians to show up on Eastern Parkway every Labor Day, but not one inclination, not one shred of evidence that anybody's organizing those West Indians. They show up, they spend upwards of $80 million on that day, and they have a good time, and see you next year. Meanwhile, salient issues affecting that community, immigration is one, education is one, employment, and so forth. Those things are not important on that day, and nobody makes it important on that day. So you have 2 million opportunities to maximize your power, and you do nothing about it. But okay, back to Obama. Obama saw that the Democratic Party could not tolerate and would not tolerate the speed at which he intended to go. So he constructed a true alternative to that, which he still has not lent the Democratic Party. He still owns his own little separate operation. And was it that magical? No, very simple. It's a basic, simple thing. You organize, so that by the time you declare your intention, you have solid information about your constituency, about your political base, and they are different, my friends. A political constituency is different from a political base. He had both. What is the difference? A political constituency is that fickle group of people who would love you today but hate you tomorrow. Or they would love you as long as you favor this position or that position. They love you as long as they think you love them. A political base would be those people you purposely romance. You talk to them, you cultivate a relationship with them, and they will walk through the fire with you because they believe in you and you've given them reason to believe in you. Of course, you sense I'm coming up to a criticism about the Green Party, aren't you? And you're right. You have to be present in the communities from which you expect political victory. You have to make an investment. You have to tell people that you are not there to dictate to them what their issues are, but you are there to serve their issues and interests. And you build not just a constituency. You'll have, you know, fickle people who would still bolt because person X looks more amenable to their positions, whatever it is they think they are. But you build a political base. So this is not magical. This is not great. This is fundamental organizing principles. You invest in your success. Everybody was talking about, oh my gosh, this is going to be a tough race. Of course, when has it not been a tough race for anybody black, whether in politics or outside of politics? When has it not been tough? But he constructed his architecture, and you can't get away from that. And that is what a lot of the black leadership, a lot of leadership across the board won't do. They won't do it. It's too much work. It's very unsexy. And in this regard, because Barack Obama took this so very seriously, nobody saw it coming because it was very unattractive work. Nobody saw it coming. But little by little, almost all of my friends who are in the arts, by the way, would, when we talked, would tell me, oh, I'm, one of them just recently said to me, oh, I'm singing at a fundraiser for Barack Obama tonight. Another one is on a tour bus. Nobody saw that, but it was happening. So by the time he decided to run for president, he knew where he had to go. Now, I may be giving Barack Obama too much personal credit. There may be a situation where a system was designed for him, but either way, he paid for it because he raised the money as well. And we know, yes, it's super PACs and all of that, but it was super PACs for Mitt Romney too. And if the objective is to win, you do what you have to do. And you get yourself situated in a way where you construct the vehicle that will deliver success for you. That is my criticism, again, of independent parties and third-party efforts. They act like it's a sin to want to win. And every 4 years, we have a repeat of the same cycle, as we did in this cycle. All of the third-party efforts yielded just about 1% of all votes cast. And it's a good thing, I guess. But when you look at it in perspective, that has been the consistent number for the past several years, past several presidential cycles. It's the same statistic. Now, why would anybody want to support a failing prospect of repeated failures, repeated losses? Why would you want to do that? You want somebody who indicates that they're serious about winning and has an articulated goal or a set of articulated goals that can reasonably be achieved successfully. So in a way, Barack Obama is really running a third party effort within the mainstream party. It doesn't look like it, but it smells like it. The Democratic Party, as currently constituted, even though he's the head of it, the Democratic Party, as currently constituted, cannot and will not tolerate a Barack Obama on his own terms. So as security, you organize your own. Well, we go beyond this now. And we talk about the attitudes of toward this race, not just by the nation, but by the people who are the gatekeepers of what we think and hear and see in the way of information, the people who control our minds on a daily basis, having a public meltdown, a temper tantrum. But they're not actually saying what is bothering them. They're saying, well, it's his positions on this issue or that. It's the fact that he's heading a do-nothing Congress, as if Barack Obama is now personally responsible for everything that's gone wrong with the nation, which is typical. It's typical because they are operating from a typical place. And the typical place they're operating from is a place of absolute, undiluted fear. That has been the traditional stimulus for all kinds of actions and responses in the United States. An inherent, deep-seated, racist fear that A, no black man should ever, or black person, should ever be in charge of anything. They lack the capacities to do so. And it is interesting that, in effect, we all agree that Obama is black, which is itself mind-boggling. The man is a product of an African, a relationship and marriage between an African man and a European-American woman. The very fact that we interpret Barack Obama as a black man is derivative of slave law. actual slave law. It is called loosely the one-drop rule. In the United States, there are only two realities. You're either black or you're either white or you're not. Okay? You are either white or you are not. That's the double helix of racism in the United States. You're either white or you're not. And it applies to the common person. It applies even to a person running as president of the United States who currently is president of the United States. The one-drop rule. Barack Obama was made to be an African-American because of the one-drop rule, slave law. One drop of black blood makes you black. That was a law. Right into the 20th century. And the one drop of black blood makes you black, and that is stuff I want to translate here, makes you black, i.e. inferior. The one drop of black blood that you have makes you eligible for membership in only one group, and that is the not white group. And the not white group is always inferior. So in the minds of Mitt Romney and others of that ilk, an imposter, an inferior person has been at the helm of this country already for 4 years, and damn it, we're not going to have him another 4 years. At the beginning of his first term, the articulated mission in the U.S. Senate, where he came from, Barack Obama, the articulated mission was to make absolutely sure that he gets nothing done, nothing achieved, nothing accomplished that would bolster his argument for re-election. But in any event, whether that happens or not, the main aim and objective was to absolutely block him from achieving anything. They didn't hide it. It was actually said repeatedly. Boehner, the great Republican leader, actually said that. We're going to make sure that this man never achieves a thing. And they were true to their word. They got not a thing done in 3 years. The country is going to hell, but that's not important. What's more important is their psychological need to eviscerate blackness from circles of power. Because that's where they believe they derive their true power, is ultimately in their superiority, their supremacy as whites in the United States. So Romney was symbolically the messenger to that part of America that still held to those views. What's more important than employment, than health care, than immigration, than anything else is the psychological anchor around which all of this is run and stabilized. A country, just the sheer presence of a black man, as they say, in the White House, has threatened the fundamental vision of America. And the fundamental vision of America, as it had been with all of the European colonists, is that whiteness is the principal tool on which all things are done. Whiteness must prevail. as the preferred position because it means by inference, everything else is subservient to it. Now, if you don't get that message, you don't understand what is going on here. And I tell you this as well. I'm coming back to the subject repeatedly, but I want to round out this discussion. In the old days, in Frederick Douglass's days, when the issue was women's rights, i.e. white women's rights, suffrage, they were never discussing black women. All of the women agreed. All of the women in that struggle agreed. This was about us, white women in America. It has nothing to do with black folks. Black women are here in America to help nurse our white children and cook and clean and do the chores. We are not, there was no remote idea that they were fighting for all women. One of the greatest feminists that the United States has ever had, and I'm referring to Frederick Douglass. Yes, he was a feminist. He went all over the country bolstering their position. He went all over the world. He went all through Europe. Everywhere he went, he talked about the injustice against women, i.e. white women, and likened it to his own interest, which was abolition of slavery. It was also as a result of Frederick Douglass's lobbying that white women won the right to vote. Now, do you know that when the time came and Fred thought, well, hey, I have some allies here in my struggle. I need you now to speak up about ending slavery. They said, no, Freddie, you got this whole thing wrong. We expected you to stand up because, you know, you have that gift of gab and all that. You know all those multisyllabic words, and you are a profound thinker. But thank you, but this is over. We are not about abolition. We're about white women getting the right to vote. In the civil rights movement, same pattern. Black folks took all kinds of violence against them, for the most part. Yes, there were whites who participated. And many whites who did participate came under the wrath of their own communities, even to the point of being murdered for their involvement in rights for all people. But in the civil rights struggle, what we know as the civil rights struggle, the modern civil rights struggle, that is, black folks and their suffering and their leadership on this issue yielded incredible benefits for a whole bunch of other folk. So it was on the back of that struggle that a whole group, any numbers of people benefited from the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which became effective in 1965. I tell you this now, and you may not remember it, but I'm telling you, a hidden part of this experience that we're witnessing now, Barack Obama's phenomenal return for a second term, and even from the very beginning, is being set up to be the benchmark or the launching pad for a whole bunch of folks who now will feel empowered to run for president but who are not putting the requisite donation in the pot. I speak of Hillary Clinton. Anywhere you see the Clintons, you know that there is at least five other agendas going. Bill, of course, was on the road. He made it clear, hey, this is my guy. And I'm almost a soul brother because I play the saxophone, you know. But imagine that, the irony of it. An impeached president actually being in the position, this is again based on the racist attitudes that prevail in America. Here's an impeached man who was necessary just simply because he was a white man to confer some degree of credibility in a black man who has more than enough credentials on his own. But even that wasn't enough. Impeached as he was, Bill Clinton still had more credibility in the eyes of America than Barack Obama. Ain't that a blip? So this brings me to the final note that beginning and possibly before 2008, when Barack Obama decided that he was going to run for president, plans were assembled and plans were being made, A, because they knew they had a winner here, and there was a confluence of interest. He was interested in higher office and had ambitions. A group of people who are yet to be totally defined had their set of interests. And Barack Obama was the perfect test case, the perfect balloon launch to see if it was possible in this time to break through the barriers of politics. And what do you know? Everything worked out perfectly. So now that the black guy has taken the heat of it, the white women will come in right after that, and other, quote, ethnic groups, unquote. You can be sure of it. So in this sense, there's nothing that's new. There's nothing that's new. Barack Obama, in large measure, is the launching pad. We saw two women get elected, one openly gay, and one who toppled a longtime Republican opponent. That happened also on the strength of the climate, the political climate created by Barack Obama's candidacy. But in the next 4 years, they will be planning and strategizing. Hillary Clinton, who you know is a person I have great questions about, she's completely unqualified for her job. She's not the only one in the Obama administration. And it attests the incredible power and influence of the Clintons. By the way, another Chicago connection, Hillary Clinton was born in Chicago. So Chicago is a center here for a particular style of politics. As a white woman in America, nobody has ever asked, how did she go from the White House to the U.S. Senate in one fell swoop without running for anything? How did that happen? And I dare somebody to tell me that that was all fair and square. That she earned it on her merits. No. The white women are also playing the white man's game. They don't have any problem with that. No problem whatsoever. When it's convenient, they start talking about women's rights. But they invariably agree with white men that any people of color don't matter. We don't matter. It started with Frederick Douglass. That's why I illustrated the point with Frederick Douglass. They invariably agree with the white men they disagree with. That the formula still remains, you're either white or you are not. Black folks running around talking about they're black and proud and whatever it is, not in America. In America, it's important that you understand not who you are, but who you're not. That's what is important to keep you grounded, because that is the prevailing view. That is the prevailing philosophy. For your own self-defense, you ought to get hip to that and proceed accordingly. Hillary Clinton is completely unqualified for that job. But that was a concession made when Bill was caught in the Oval Office. And she stood by his side, proving, of course, you know, that you can make accommodations and still thump your chest that you are a new age woman. If you were a new age woman, there's no way you would still be a Clinton. But she plays the game of the men and wrangled the position of Secretary of State. That was her prize, her political prize, and she got it from the same guy she said was unqualified to be president of the United States. And how could the country allow a person in so important a job who has to go through a period of on-the-job training as if she hasn't? And I tell you, what is miraculous about it all is that in the midst of this campaign, one of the most potentially lethal blows to Barack Obama's success was Hillary Clinton and the situation in Benghazi as Secretary of State, an utter and complete failure, and she should not have that job. And what's now the case is the president is covering for her, saying, hey, you know, she did her job well. No, no. If the roles were reversed, Barack Obama would have been long gone. Long gone. So, all right. I laid my case out today in the first part. We have to catch up. We have to catch up about looking at the situation from a different point of view. The experts are talking one-dimensionally. There are people in the United States, and there are many of us, who have an entirely different point of reference by virtue of an entirely different history. And that makes it completely legitimate to see the world through a prism shaped by these experiences. Don't tell me what my priorities are, and don't tell me what my interest is. Don't tell me who my friends are and who my enemies are and what I ought to think and what I ought not to think. This piece of real estate is owned entirely by me and people like me. And we see it for what it is. In the middle of all of this triumph about Barack Obama, let's not get it lost that there's a story here, there is a narrative here that will never, ever be presented in the rawness that it is. America doesn't have the stomach for that. And that's okay. But the people who do have this point of reference would do a disservice to themselves if they forget it or if they lose their bearings due to the extraordinary amount of quote, information, unquote, supplied them by racist media and by a media that has a convenient memory. So, to summarize, A, Barack Obama's success is rooted in a peculiar form of black politics. And I don't use the word peculiar in a negative way at all. Peculiar meaning distinctly different. Two, he understood, and in many ways, Barack Obama is himself, even as president. The very fact that he had to organize an alternative tells you that he recognized the system would never have accommodated his political ambitions, nor the political ambitions and aspirations of his own people, if you want to put it that way. So he had to construct an alternative. Number three, Barack Obama's spectacular success is not going to be forgiven anytime soon. It will not be forgiven. Number four, Barack Obama's spectacular successes in both his first and now, hopefully, in his second term is a trial balloon for people who have not necessarily made the requisite investment, but have used this period as a way of testing, analyzing, and utilizing the methods developed in the course of these 8 years in which he's to be in office. And immediately after Barack Obama leaves, and certainly we'll begin to see that in the midterm elections for Congress in the next 2 years, you will see people showing up all over the place as if, hey, it's my turn. It's my turn. They will never credit Obama for that, but they will utilize his run in 2008 and 2012 as the bellwether for their own chances at, quote, regaining power. And when they do, mark my word, they will still agree. They will still return to the old formula that in the United States, there's only one thing that people need to pay attention to. You are either white or you're not. Thus endeth my epistle for the day. Well, I thank you for allowing me to get this off my chest. We will continue this discussion. We have to, because there's a lot more to discuss, but we will continue this discussion. Be sure of it. You can write me, drop me a line at leadstories@gmail.com, leadstories@gmail.com. I would be delighted to know what you're thinking. And I thank you for indulging me because, you know, from time to time, it seems there is a need to just put things in perspective this way because there's a marked absence of it in the media that we readily have access to. And should I say, the media that readily has access to our minds. So I thought I would present these thoughts to you because they need to be heard. So we will tune in again to each other tomorrow, God willing, and the creek don't rise. I want to talk to you tomorrow. We have some very interesting discussions about the Latino vote coming up tomorrow. But I thank you for the pleasure and the privilege of your company. Remember, reach me at leadstories, leidstories@gmail.com. Thank you so much.